Julia Mahoney. I'm the Education Program Administrator for Renew Theaters. Our organization manages the Ambler, the County, the Princeton Garden, and the Highway Theaters. So I want to thank all of you from our different theaters for joining us. And if you are not a member of one of our theaters, I want to welcome you as well. Programs like these are possible due to the support of our members, as well as the support of the VESTA Fund, which has given us a grant for our online seminar series, Deep Focus. We are also partnering with the Majestic in Gettysburg, so I want to thank them as well. So before we jump into tonight's program, It Happened One Night, I wanted to mention a couple of events that we have coming up in the next few weeks. Next Tuesday evening, our very own Chris Collier, Executive Director of Renew Theaters, will be leading a seminar on the new film, The Batman, which you can currently catch playing at all four of our theaters. And in 2 weeks, we will continue our French New Wave series with a talk on the 400 Blows, led by Professor Richard Newport and French New Wave expert. That will be showing at the County next Wednesday evening, March 23rd, and at the Ambler and Princeton Garden next Thursday evening, March 24th. You can find more information about any past and upcoming talks at our website, deepfocus.film. Now, most of you probably already know our Zoom protocols, but I think we have some new faces tonight, so I'm just going to do a quick refresher. Most of all, we ask that you remain on mute, especially in the beginning when Hannah is talking, and then we'll open things up to conversation. If you do have a question, please raise your hand or use the raise hand feature. I will start by moderating the discussion, and then as things get moving a bit, we can get a little bit more free-flowing with each other. Also, the chat feature is enabled, and there's often a very lively sidebar conversation in the chat, so please feel free to make use of that. It is my pleasure to turn things over to Hannah Jack. For those of you joining us for the first time, Hannah is a writer for Turner Classic Movies and has scripted many of the introductions which you hear if you watch TCM. We are so happy to have Hannah hosting this classic film series for us. So with that, I turn it over to you, Hannah.
Great, hi everybody. Thank you so much for being here tonight. It's such a joy to see so many returning faces and also to see people joining us for the very first time. I see a lot of faces and names that I haven't seen month after month here, which is wonderful. So welcome if you're joining for the first time or for the first time in a while. And please feel free to continue to share this series that's going on month after month, in addition to all the other wonderful programming that Julia just mentioned. And speaking of which, we have started to line up the titles for the next couple months. I am extremely excited that Chris, who was unable to be here tonight, has plans to bring these movies to the theaters in the Renew Network. And so hopefully we'll be able to catch some of those. Did anyone get to see It Happened One Night on the big screen this week? Okay, awesome. That's really exciting. So hopefully we'll be able to continue to present the movies that we will be talking about month after month in the theaters as well. So that's why we're sort of lining it up as far ahead of time as we can. So I'll announce next month's title, because that's what we've been doing at the top of the hour here. Next month, wherever possible, as I often say, I'd like to tie into the programming on Turner Classic Movies, because I know that there are a lot of TCM viewers in the crowd. And it's fun, I think, to be able to see some of the more, you know, see the movie on TV within the broader theme. It kind of like enhances the viewing. I think if you can catch a couple titles as part of that theme, that's a lot of fun too. So next month is April, and there is going to be a weekend. It's actually the weekend leading up to our next talk. Our next talk will be on Tuesday, April 12th. And the weekend before that, TCM is spending an April weekend in Paris with a 48-hour marathon of movies set in Paris. And what better time of year to go to Paris mentally? And so one of those movies is our next title for next month, is the classic 1939 comedy Ninotchka. So we will be talking all things director Ernst Lubitsch, all things Greta Garbo, And there are a lot of fun players involved in that that we haven't talked about in this series so far. One who we have talked about is the one of the writers of that movie, Billy Wilder. We've talked about him in the past as a writer and director. So we have looked in this series at Witness for the Prosecution and Sunset Boulevard, which he directed. But Nanochka is a movie that he co-wrote but didn't direct. So that's another fun kind of angle on his work too. So anyway, Nanochka is coming up. I see some people excited about that for next month on Tuesday, April 12th. And if you'd like to spend the whole weekend in Paris, that will be one of the titles. I wrote the intros to those movies. And so tune in that weekend, especially on TCN. And yes, famously Greta Garbo, it was her first comedy. So that'll be a fun thing to talk about too. So we're in the realm of comedy too for this month. And I'm sure that for many people here tonight, this was not a first time viewing of It Happened One Night. It's an uber classic. It's a movie that I think a lot of people return to time and again. I know personally a lot of people who use this to introduce their friends to classic movies because it's kind of a good gateway classic too. I think a lot of people can enjoy it. So I'm gonna go ahead and share my screen to give us some visuals as I talk about the movie. I'll give a bit of background. And as ever, you should see Clark Gable and Claudette Colbert. Do you see that now? Great. As ever, if you have questions or comments or thoughts that you want to bring up as I'm talking, go ahead and fill the chat. We will come back to it. But in the meantime, I'll give a little bit of background about this movie. So obviously one of the reasons why I picked this film was because it involves a lot of people who we haven't talked about in the previous months, the stars and the director. These are all new figures in our particular series. But the reason I chose this movie for this month has to do with its Academy Awards related history. So at the end of March this year is the 94th Academy Awards. And on Turner Classic Movies every year, Oscars month means only one thing programming wise, which is 31 days of Oscar, which is exactly what it sounds like, 31 days of Oscar winning and nominated movies that TCN airs the whole month leading up to the Academy Awards. This year, it's not nominated movies, it's only the winners. So for 31 days, and we're right in the middle of it right now, for the whole month of March, if you turn on Turner Classic Movies, you will be seeing an Oscar winning movie. It's all back to back around the clock for 31 days. And what's fun also this year is that if you don't have TCM, but you do have the streaming service HBO Max, for the first time ever, TCM has created a parallel 31 Days of Oscar festival that you can stream on HBO Max. So what you have here, I just am showing you the two kind of like promo images for these two things, but Turner Classic Movies is one of the many channels that contributes content to HBO Max. So if you have HBO Max, it's very, very easy. You just open it and go all the way to the bottom. At the very bottom, you'll see all the channels that contribute content and you click on TCM. And from there, you'll see all the movies, all the classic movies that TCM has programmed that are available on HBO Max. This year, what's great is that in March, the Oscar winning movies have been added with introductions delivered by the TCM hosts, which I wrote, but they're all there. And they give context for these movies too. And I also got a chance to work on a lot of the movies that are on air too. So lots of Oscar stuff. And that's one of the reasons why It Happened One Night was this month's pick, because it holds a very unique place in Oscars history. It also holds a very unique place in movie history as being what many people refer to as the very first screwball comedy. So a word for a moment about screwball comedy before I kind of get into the making of this movie. Screwball comedy came out of this period in the early 1930s, mid-1930s, really, as many people say, beginning in 1934 with It Happened One Night. It's seen as the movie that kind of launched this genre. The screwball comedy is a subgenre of the romantic comedy, and it has kind of its own unique markers that make it a screwball comedy as opposed to just any other kind of romantic comedy. For one thing, these movies came out of the Depression era, at a time when audiences really wanted and needed a wacky, escapist kind of happy fantasy on screen. What screwball comedies often do, especially in the 1930s, is kind of turn the world on its head. The rich are stupid and don't succeed in the end, and they're wacky and zany and hopelessly misguided. And the poor and the everyman are celebrated. They're the ones who triumph in the end. They're the ones who have their act together and are winning the day. So that was a dynamic that kind of was something Depression era audiences really appreciated. It also was just very, very sophisticated and wacky, blended together. It gave audiences something kind of fun to look at, something beautiful and glamorous, always fast-paced, always with fast-paced dialogue, lots of sight gags and comic relief, all these zany situations. And one of the things that it did also was it really gave women terrific roles, because often in these screwball comedies, it's the woman who's driving the plot and driving the action and pursuing the man. And so again, like turning romance and romantic, the traditional tropes on their head. And so It Happened One Night really began this. The last thing that really characterized screwball comedies, which again, this was a genre that very much came out of the mid 1930s and continued into the 1940s. That's kind of like the golden age of screwball comedy, was that it was made, these movies were made right at the time when the production code started to become strictly enforced. It Happened One Night got in just under the wire. In 1934 is when the production code became strictly enforced. The production code, of course, was the censorship rules that said what could and could not be put on screen. And so lots of things, namely sex, could no longer be put on screen in the way that it had been earlier in the 1930s. And I'll give you a little teaser. We're going to talk pre-code coming down the pike pretty soon in this series. But for right now, we're right at the very end of the pre-code era, where It Happened One Night gets away with things that a couple months later you couldn't get away with on screen. I'll talk more about that in a minute. But these screwball comedies came out of an era where they had to get creative about how the sexual chemistry and dynamic was going to play out. And so all of these crazy situations had to arise where there's a lot of pursuit and talk around sex without it ever happening or without anybody really showing any skin or doing anything scandalous on screen. So again, lighter, fluffier stuff than some of the more romantic, salacious things that came before it. Okay, so these are what you're looking at here are just some of the screwball comedies that It Happened One Night kind of opened the gates for, all classic movies from the 1930s and 40s. So how did It Happen One Night kind of come to be? It originated with a short story called Night Bus, and this is actually a still from the movie. There's the sign that says Night Bus to New York. You see this sign in the movie. The original short story title was Night Bus. It was written in 1933 and passed around to all the major Hollywood studios, and nobody picked it up. It landed at Columbia Pictures. And at this time in 1934, the big studios in Hollywood were MGM and Fox and Paramount and Warner Brothers and RKO. And then there were the Poverty Row studios, the ones that churned out these B movies, low budget, not prestigious pictures. They did not have prestigious stars. And Columbia Pictures was effectively a Poverty Row studio. It was not a big player in Hollywood at this point. It did not have its own stable of movie stars that were under contract. So Columbia Pictures was this dinky little studio still at this point. And it was run by a man named Harry Cohn. And you see him on the left there in that picture. And really the star asset that he had in the 1930s was a man named Frank Capra, the director of It Happened One Night. And Harry Cohn and Frank Capra got hold of this story, Night Bus, and they wanted to make it. So just another quick word though about these two guys. Harry Cohn, who's there on the left, took the reins of Columbia just a few years earlier, before It Happened One Night was made. And he worked extremely hard to build his studio into a substantial player in Hollywood. And so the reason we know anything about Columbia Pictures owes a lot to his work. He was also a terrible human being. And if you read anything about Columbia Pictures under the reign of Harry Cohn, you will not find a nice word said about him. He was a disgusting, horrible person. But he, you know, picked his talent where he could. And he had a huge asset, as I said, in director Frank Capra, who had only recently come to the studio. Frank Capra started out in Hollywood, importantly for this movie that we're talking about, in comedy, directing and writing short comedies for silent era short comedy producers, names you might have heard of like Hal Roach and Max Sennett. This was Frank Capra's training ground. So when we talk about him directing the first screwball comedy, it's not totally surprising because he had his roots in comedy. But when we think about Frank Capra, if that name is familiar to you, it's probably because of movies like the ones on the right-hand side here. Movies he directed like Mr. Deeds Goes to Town, You Can't Take It With You, Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, It's a Wonderful Life. These movies that are like uber classics that I think they're always the movies that make me cry, because it's like the good guys win and they're the good, wholesome, you know, real democratic American values. And he celebrated the little guy, always triumphing over the big business tycoon. And this is what Frank Capra became so famous for. Rewind though, by 1934, he had not made any of those movies. So by the time he's making It Happen One Night, nobody knew this Frank Capra. All they knew was this like up and coming director who had made one hit picture, which was the movie Lady for a Day in 1933. So this is where he's at when he gets hold of this little short story and, you know, decides to make it. Night Bus, AKA It Happened One Night, was originally slated to star these two people, Robert Montgomery and Myrna Loy. And if you know these two actors, you can try to imagine what this movie might have looked like with them in it, but it would not look like what it became. They were both under contract to MGM. And like I said, Columbia really didn't have its own stars. It had to always borrow from different studios. So Columbia tried to borrow Robert Montgomery from MGM. And Robert Montgomery said no, because there had been a lot of movies recently about bus travel that had not been hits. And so he was like, I don't want to do another bus picture. And so he said no. Myrna Loy also turned it down, as did a number of other stars like Miriam Hopkins and Constance Bennett and Maureen Sullivan. And nobody seemed interested. And the only reason that Claudette Colbert was interested was, and she really wasn't, I mean, interested is a stretch. The only reason she accepted it was because Capra promised her twice, or double her usual salary. And she happened to have 4 weeks off before a vacation that she had planned. And he promised her that she could finish in 4 weeks. So double the salary and, you know, make it in this 4 week period she had off and be done. So she accepted. She was not interested though in this movie at all, and especially in working with Frank Capra. What you see there all the way on the left is what was Claudette Colbert's film debut back in 1927. In a silent romance called For the Love of Mike. Her debut was directed by Frank Capra. That was the only other movie they made together. And she did not have a positive experience working with him, and she did not remember that fondly. So she didn't want to work with him again. In the meantime, she had become a big star at Paramount mostly, in these lavish historic epics directed by Cecil B. DeMille, movies like The Sign of the Cross and Cleopatra. And there you can see she's like very provocatively dressed in these, like, you know, she became like this kind of like vamp figure in these movies. And 1934, earlier the same year, she also gave a really compelling melodramatic performance in the original Imitation of Life. So Claudette Colbert was a star in a very different genres, never in a comedy. This was her first time. And when I watch her in this movie, my mind is blown by that, because she's just so good at it. But this was really, she wasn't primed for this in any way, and had no interest in it, even when production began. The same went for her co-star. Clark Gable was also under contract at a different studio, in his case, MGM. And he had only just become a star. He'd been in movies for a while, but he only just broke through as a big, the hottest new star at MGM. And he's there, you see him next to MGM's head, Louis B. Mayer. And at this point, Mayer decided to loan Clark Gable out to Columbia for It Happened One Night as punishment, because Gable had been acting a little too big for his britches. He had been, recently become a big star and was starting to turn down assignments. And Louis B. Mayer wanted to rein him in and teach him a lesson. So he sent Gable as a disciplinary action off to this second-rate studio to make this little movie that nobody thought anything of. And Gable went very reluctantly. And Frank Capra had these two stars on his hand who didn't really want to make this movie and was ready to say, all right, let's forget it. But Harry Cohn, who knew Louis B. Mayer was the head of Hollywood, more or less, said, no, Louis B. Mayer is giving us Clark Gable. We're making a movie with Clark Gable. And that's how this movie even happened. So the movie started out, and Gable and Frank Capra did end up quickly kind of hitting it off. And what Gable appreciated was that Capra told him to just be himself on screen. And so it brought out this much more natural, much more authentic Clark Gable performance than many of the things he had been in before. And so they hit it off. Claudette Colbert still had no interest the whole production. And when the film premiered in 1934, the initial reviews were very mediocre. And the studio actually pulled it from theaters briefly and reissued it. And what ended up happening was that people started to, the word of mouth started to spread, and people started to tell their friends, and then more people came. And before anyone knew it, it was one of the biggest hits of the year, just by word of mouth, just because people kept telling other people to go see it, and they kept going to see it again. And it's not, I don't think, it's not too hard to understand why they, audiences took, responded well to it. It's an entertaining movie. But it also, I think, owes a lot, credit where credit is due, which is to a shirtless Clark Gable and Claudette Colbert's leg exposed, which were big things in 1934. I mean, people were excited to go to the movies to go see this. In this time, what would have been shown on screen more often was a man undressing and having an undershirt on. And Gable apparently couldn't gracefully take off his undershirt and say the fast-paced dialogue. So they just dispensed with the undershirt in this scene where he undresses. And that caused a sensation, and undershirt sales plummeted in this country. Men, decided if Gable is not wearing an undershirt, or I guess women told them, you can do without it too. And so they stopped, buying undershirts. And with Claudette Colbert and that famous hitchhiking moment, she didn't want to expose her leg for Frank Capra. Again, like I said, she didn't think very much of him as a director. She had been essentially naked in Cecil B. DeMille movies, but wouldn't do it here. And Capra hired a chorus girl to double for her leg, to be the one whose leg you see on screen. And Claudette Colbert saw her and said, get rid of her, that's not my leg. And so she stepped in and did it, and it is her leg that we see in it. But when filming wrapped, Claudette Colbert apparently told her friends that she just made the worst film of her career. She still had no good impression of it after everything. So nobody was more surprised, I think, than Claudette Colbert when the Oscars rolled around in 1935, and little Columbia Pictures that had almost no votes in the Academy voting process because it was such a tiny studio, nobody thought a Columbia Pictures film would win the Oscars. And it did. Clark Gable won as Best Actor. It became what remained his one and only Oscar win. He was nominated again two more times for Mutiny on the Bounty and as Rhett Butler in Gone with the Wind. And this was the only time he won, was for It Happened One Night. So he won for Best Actor. Frank Capra won his first Oscar as Best Director. He would win again two more times. And then Claudette Colbert didn't even think she was in the running, because she was up against the likes of Norma Shearer, who was the queen of the MGM lot for the Barretts of Wimpole Street. She was up against Betty Davis for Of Human Bondage. She was up against Myrna Loy for The Thin Man. Incidentally, Gable was up against William Powell for The Thin Man too. And Claudette Colbert thought, no way am I winning for this. So she was at the train station ready to board the train to New York when they ushered her away and rushed her to the ballroom to accept the Oscar that she had won. So that's why you see her there in her traveling clothes. She's not in any kind of Oscars dress. She took her award and went back to the train to go take her trip. So if you're keeping track here, there's the movie won Best Actor, Best Actress, Best Director. It also won for Best Adapted Screenplay by a man named Robert Riskin, who has been called kind of like the secret to Frank Capra's success, because he wrote many of the movies that Frank Capra became famous for. Didn't write Mr. Smith Goes to Washington or It's a Wonderful Life, but wrote all the other movies that we think of as Frank Capra classics. So he won for Best Adapted Screenplay. Again, actor, actress, director, screenplay. It also won for Best Picture of 1934. The Oscars had only been around since the Academy Awards, I should say, had only been around since 1927. So these are the movies on the left there that had won the Oscars, won the Best Picture prize up to this point. It Happened One Night became the first comedy ever to win the Best Picture award. And it 2 years later, or 4 years later, I should say, the next time the Best Picture prize went to a comedy, which was again directed by Frank Capra, You Can't Take It With You. So Capra's comedies kind of set the tone for what could be a Best Picture contending comedy. And so it made history as winning the best, being the first comedy to win the Best Picture Oscar. So that's all five. That's Best Picture, Actor, Actress, Director, and Screenplay. Those are considered the big five of the Academy Awards. And It Happened One Night was the first movie ever to get all of those five Oscars. And it remained the only movie to win all five for 41 years. It's only happened two more times, and that's with One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest in 1975 and Silence of the Lambs in 1991. These are only three movies have ever won all five of those Oscars. So that is why, bringing it all full circle, this movie was my pick for this month, because it really holds a very unique place in Oscars history in particular. So I'm going to shut up now. I would love to hear all of your thoughts. And I'm going to stop sharing my screen. Here we go. All right. And I don't know if things came in the chat, but I would love to hear all of your thoughts about this movie, maybe about screwball comedies and any of the questions that you may have about this movie. Again, use the raise hand feature or just unmute yourself. Julia is moderating, so she'll call on anybody who raises their hand.
Carolyn.
Hi, I just wanted to say I love this movie. And one of the great things for me about this movie is that there's a small role for like my favorite character actor ever, Ward Bond. And he has one of the exchanges in the whole movie, the whole, oh yeah, back and forth with Clark Gable. That makes me laugh. I've seen this movie, I don't even know how many times, but it makes me laugh every time. I like that whole scene on the bus, the first bus, anyway.
Yeah, there are so many great character actors who show up so briefly in this movie. I mean, really, it's like a two-person movie for the most part. It's mostly just the two stars and arguably, Ellie's father. But yeah, Ward Bond, at this point in his career, I mean, when we think Ward Bond, I mean, very often, like, all of his John Ford movies come to mind. Like, he was such an integral part of John Ford's stock company and gave all these performances. But he didn't really start to take on bigger roles until, like, the 1940s. He spent, like, two decades playing these bit parts, and he's not even credited in the movie. But yeah, he's the one who's the first bus driver who says, you know, oh yeah, yeah, you know, that whole exchange. It's great. It's great to thank you for pointing it out.
Doug?
Yeah, maybe you could talk about what this did to Columbia Pictures, because you said it was Poverty Row, heavy prestige. How quickly did that propel them to the so-called major leagues and et cetera, et cetera? Yeah.
Such a good question. Yeah. It did a lot of, you know, in terms of making Hollywood take note of what was going on there. And certainly in terms of boosting Frank Capra's career, because he was able to then make much more prestigious films. He was able to attract more prestigious talent to his movies. And so what you end up getting is that within a couple years, with his help specifically, people like Gene Arthur come to Columbia and become stars. And so Columbia starts to be able to get talent in its own studio and become sort of more of a competitive player in the industry. And that was a lot of, it had a lot to do with the fact that Capra became a star first as a director and was able to attract a lot more prestige around his productions.
Brian.
Yeah, in your introduction, you said about using this film as a gateway to classic films. And I've tried to do that with this film a few times. And some modern audiences have a couple problems with it. The film so successfully sets the blueprint for romantic comedies. They've seen a lot of what this film does so many times that it doesn't seem fresh or as innovative as it was at the time, as it is. And the other thing some people have a problem with is the gender roles, how Colbert's character is always put down. She kind of gives as good as she gets, but there's one point where Gable just smacks her on the butt as a reprimand. And that takes a lot of people out of the film. You can almost feel them kind of cross their arms and go harumph at that point and just ignore the rest of the film, unfortunately. So
yeah, that's so interesting. I'd love to open that up to everybody. What do you think of the gender dynamic the dynamic between the man and the woman, I guess, centrally in this, and maybe her relationship with all the other men? It's a very man heavy cast.
Hello.
Yeah. Hey, Val.
Hi, how you doing? I agree, but we're looking at it through lens of 2021, 2022. You know, I think back then, certainly she is a strong woman. I believe she's a strong woman who must have had her own mind and made her own career decisions. So she's like trailblazer maybe, or like a Betty Davis. There's no messing around with Betty Davis or Claudette Colbert, I think. But I think an audience today just has to take that into consideration. It's made in 1934. And unfortunately, you have these men smacking you on the butt. And of course, today you would be like, what? But if you can kind of look past that and look at the lens of 1934, I mean, I've seen this movie maybe 100 times and I still laugh at the him doing, I do it this way, or no, I do it that. I scream laughing at that. And Alan Hale singing, you know, young people in love are seldom hungry.
Yes.
Oh my gosh. And I mean, it's not from my time, not from my generation, but boy, oh boy, do I laugh my head off throughout the whole movie. You know, yeah, I think you have to look past some of that stuff because we're looking at it from a modern perspective, you know, how our culture is today. But back then, but she succeeded. You know what I mean? Like, to me, she made her way through that. So anyway, enough said.
Absolutely. I'm so glad that you pointed out that we have to see it through that time, because something else that is important about seeing it through that time is seeing it through the Depression era eyes, because she's the rich person. And so it was would have been seen very differently to see, you know, the average everyday news reporter who doesn't have, you know, $2 to put together kind of smacking the rich heiress to smack a little sense into her. That was something people would have cheered. So, you know, and to see really the arc of the story when you look at it in terms of the Depression is getting this kind of every man to bring this socialite down to earth and to, you know, imbue her with the values of everyday people. And so that, I think, is very much what was on the minds of audiences at the time when they were looking at this movie.
I think we have a lot of hands in response to you, Hannah, but I just want to point out Alan in the chat saying that she's strong enough to jump off a moving ship, dive into the water, and escape her dad's security system.
Very true. Yes.
And then we'll go with Polly.
Yeah, I'll just quickly add that the father's control over her when she's a grown adult, legally adult woman is also kind of hard to take, but I totally agree. You have to view it, or you know, if you want to enjoy it, you need to not view it with present eyes. But I did want to add to that I think Claudette Colbert is so wonderful, but it is also hard for me to believe that she couldn't take care of herself because she's so obviously competent and Claudette Colbert in so many ways. But that's a small quibble, I guess.
No, absolutely. No, fair point.
Remy?
Yeah, I think it's an interesting take on the whole damsel in distress story. And I've always thought of it as, you know, a feminist version of the damsel in distress, but set in that specific time period, you know, there was only so much she could have the agency to do on her own. And she really, the sort of sexism she comes up against throughout the entire thing is very of the era. She is actively, you know, she jumps off the ship. She is taking control of her life, but she can only go so far. There's so many barriers to her actually being able to have the agency to be the feminist that she wants to be. So it's an interesting sort of like microcosm of that era of feminism and the limits to that she was able to actually, you know, succeed in some ways. How she really does need him or needs a man to get through a lot of, you know, what she is trying to accomplish. I think it's very much of that era of, you know, of that storytelling, but you know, it's augmented and compounded by the, you know, the fact that she doesn't have any money too, which I think has also probably resonated a lot with the people who were trying to make their way in the world throughout the Depression and just coming up against barrier, you know, barrier after barrier to succeed. So it's interesting that it's a comedy and it's, you know, she gets her way, you know, there's a happy ending, but it still is very much a struggle from those perspectives throughout the entire movie. I always just find it really interesting.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and to note how she functions, I mean, like I said, there are not many women in this movie, but there are a few who show up in the background here and there. And for instance, when she's in line for the showers, she doesn't know how to do that. That's not what Little Miss Rich Princess has ever had to do before. And so it's not just I don't see it always as like a, you know, a gender thing. I see it much more as a social class thing, that she is not equipped to, you know, make it in the world on her own because she's never had to. And that is what, when you look at the other screwball comedies that come out of this era, specifically movies like My Man Godfrey, the rich are absolute idiots. I mean, they just don't, they can't do anything right. And so, you know, this is very much an example of that in this moment in time of showing how the rich just, we better get together to help them because they don't have their act together. And so that's like also how this movie is kind of presenting that dynamic too. But yeah, absolutely. I see so many hands, this is great. I have to stop talking.
Tom. Or Thomas, sorry.
Tom, no, Tom is great. Yeah, you know, one of the things, you touched on it, but one of the things that struck me when I watched it this time is actually how little the Depression came through in the movie. I mean, it was very much about her, you know, Claudette Colbert meeting the common man. And you know, there was so many good scenes. The scene, as you said, you know, when she's waiting for the shower and she comes back and talks about what a great conversation she had. The scene on the bus where they're all singing, those are great scenes. But you don't see the depression. You don't see it the way, for example, you know, which had a very similar theme in My Man Godfrey, where, you know, the depression is very, very, very much a part of the movie. People aren't on the bus and have paid and getting food. They're people just living in boxes. And even Capra would come back, and that would be much more of his films, in like Meet John Doe or Mr. Deeds Goes to Town. And I just thought it was interesting that, and I wonder if it was because this was the first to kind of deal with, you know, this kind of issue. Certainly, I think probably the first for Capra, where he kept coming back to it, that the depression itself wasn't more of a character in, or a framing in this film.
Yeah, two things to that. One is that in the original drafts of this story, the Gable character was supposed to be like, I think, like a Greenwich Village painter. Like, he was supposed to be some sort of like artistic type who might have had some, you know, advanced education or something like that. And they scrapped that and made him a much more earthy, everyman newspaper reporter. So that was one effort to kind of ground his character more in the kind of person that everybody coming to the theater could relate to. But I want to throw this out to everybody, because I do think there are moments, I totally agree, it is not heavy-handed as it is in other screwball comedies of the era, and also Frank Capra movies. But where did you see the depression kind of seep in? Because there are these moments, if you kind of pause to kind of think about it. Does anything jump out to you as moments where the real struggles that people are dealing with kind of come up?
We did have some people in the chat talking about the mom and the little boy.
Right. Yeah, that's kind of the biggest one. Please, by all means, put them in the chat if you'd like to too. The woman hasn't eaten, and they're traveling together on a bus, and who knows really how affluent any of them are, but definitely that moment, I think, is a really poignant reminder that they're among people who really don't have much of anything, and it's still going on. But yeah, absolutely, it's not the center of the story as overtly as it is in other movies.
Joseph.
You know, I think that, you know, Alan Hale Sr. isn't driving a really nice car when he hits the brakes. It's run down. He's not dressed very well. Even the camp that they stay in, the people and the camp itself reeks of maybe not poor, poor depression, but not very, very rich people. Right. So they do, the people that they encounter along the road, everybody on the bus.
Yeah,
is middle America, is not to her. They're more Peter Warren than they are Claudette Colbert. But I feel sorry for people that watch movies from the 1930s and the 20s and the 40s, and you know, equate them to things that have happened here over the past 10 years, because they are just completely different movies. And this movie is not sexist, and this movie is not. And on top of it all, the strongest character in this movie is Claudette Colbert. She leaves a man at the altar. That's courageous. All right. Yeah, the guy's, you know, a drip, but she leaves him at the altar. And yes, in the beginning of the relationship, when she meets Gable, you know, Gable comes off as this tough guy, you know, he's taking control. She's going to do everything he says, all the way up to that hitchhiking scene when she blows him out of the water. From that moment on, he starts to fall for her and they start to fall for each other. I've always thought this film leaned more towards dramedy than comedy, because there's a lot of really serious scenes in this film. And there are so many, you know, this is one of those old classic movies that we can talk about certain scenes forever, whether it be on the bus, whether it be Gable coming to collect the, what is it, $39 or $49 at the end of the movie, and that little bit of dialogue between them. No one has spoken about the walls of Jericho.
Right.
And, you know, that caused all kinds of sensation. It's a perfect movie. It really is. And and it stands the test of time, and I hope it continues to stand the test of time. But I love the debate and the comments and just talking about it. So
thank you. Yeah, no, absolutely. I see so many hands. I don't want to talk so much. I want to hear what everyone thinks. Yeah.
Mary.
Thank you. I really agree with a lot of the comments, especially the previous Joseph. All of this talking about the scenes, any one of those scenes can be enjoyed without having to watch the whole movie. I think the funniest scene is the one where he's with the $39 and whatever. I think that's the funniest thing. But about the depression, I thought that the scene of her holding her toothbrush in line, waiting to take a shower, I thought that scene really was a haunt. It always haunts me that you really could see the depression of, it was still, it was quiet. She didn't know how to act. And that really always made an impression on me. And the other thing about, I agree with the folks too, about to really appreciate these movies, you have to see them in the time that they were made, not how we are today, to really, you know, to understand a little bit more about the people there that were, that made them. But anyway, thank you. That's what,
absolutely.
I had to talk about this. I just love this movie.
Good. No, great. I'm so excited that so many people are fans of this film. I think that what the movie did, which was, which maybe I guess Brian was mentioning earlier, is that it set so many of the ground rules for romantic comedies. I mean, that still people respond to today. I think, I really think that this movie in that sense, you know, does so much that really does still feel modern, that, you know, these are not two characters who, it's not love at first sight. That romance is really earned throughout the movie. You know, they develop a mutual respect. And that's something that I think audiences now look at and would admire in a movie today. I think that kind of genuine, you know, spark that blooms and grows. And so many of the other tropes about, you know, how they kind of make their way through, it's like a road picture almost, and they're kind of making their way through all these different situations together. So much of that was introduced with this movie and has been copied, you know, not as successfully ever since. And so, yeah, absolutely.
Risa.
Can you hear me?
Yeah.
As far as the depression, the exchange of the hat for gasoline, yes, the bartering, certainly seemed that. And I think when the train went by, there were hobos that he waved at, which is indicative. But what really amused me most economically was the fact that she jumped off the boat with nothing. But then she's in this beautiful outfit with a pocketbook, with clearly with makeup. And so the watch that she, you know, pawned got her a whole outfit. So I wondered what that cost. But for a little while, I was just worried about it. I had to get the clothes until it was sort of revealed. I had forgotten that.
But. Yeah, they do thankfully explain that. Yeah, exactly. And she's so used to dressing that way. She is so used to so many things. I mean, the bus will wait for her. Like, no, it won't. Right. So, right. And she has to kind of come down to earth. And that, I think, that theme is what these, I saw a great question in the chat about, you know, is this what would Depression era audiences have wanted to escape, to forget about their troubles? Yes, absolutely. But at the same time, some of the most successful films of this era directly addressed the struggles that people were going through. So because people liked seeing that too. So I think that the mix of showing what lessons people wished the rich would learn, you know, it's like, it's a very hopeful kind of commentary on that.
Alan.
Yeah, hi. This is I don't know if it's a question, maybe it is. It's a concern that something that has always perplexed me in Frank Capra's work, and Hannah, I don't know that you can answer it because you're not Frank Capra, but maybe you have some perspective on it. In his autobiography and in other things written about him, Capra is always mentioned as an arch conservative. And I find that confusing because his movies seem very rooted in 1930s and 1940s democratic ideology. I mean, and in his movies, the villains are always these sort of bloated Republican capitalists, although they're never identified as Republicans. But, you know, Edward Arnold in You Can't Take It With You, or Meet John Doe, Claude Rains in Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, and certainly Lionel Barrymore in It's a Wonderful Life, all seem to be that sort of exaggerated, you know, monopoly man capitalist. And I think my favorite moment in It Happened One Night is not one of the comedy moments, although those are great, but it's when Claudia Colbert tries to buy his assistance and he says, you know, money is the answer to everything for you. Does it ever occur to you to just say, Mister, I'm in a jam, can you help me out?
Right.
And that just feels to me like the essential Depression era democracy, you know, kind of statement. So I don't see him as a conservative in his movies, but he says he is.
I think conservative looked different in different eras. So that's one thing I would say is that he was born in Sicily and he moved to the US when he was a kid and made it as, you know, this child of immigrants, this immigrant child also. And he, you know, made it as this big time. And I think that his, you know, his values and his view of America were very, very much a celebration that anybody could make it here. And that's something that he really, really believed. And his movie is celebrated. But his, you know, his politics, I think his politics nowadays would probably look different from how they did in his time. I can't speak to it, but people who identified as, you know, aligning themselves conservatively didn't necessarily mean the same thing that it means now. So I think that it's also a look at it in its time period kind of thing. But absolutely, I think that his movies, I mean, people call it Capricorn because they are corny in a certain sense, because they tap into the best impulses in us. They celebrate our better, you know, angels. And I think that that's what makes his movies, like a movie like It's a Wonderful Life. I mean, I think that's why people come back to it year after year, because they are what we all hope people would be like, right? And that was what he was always celebrating.
Daniel.
Alrighty. So I guess I was curious about road pictures or this type of picture in general. That was kind of a question. Were they a new thing? I know movies generally were a new thing in the early 30s, but was this kind of something that was, and cars, I guess, were kind of coming onto the scene more so, and buses. So was there preceding movies over road pictures or something of this genre, so to say, in that respect? This is a question.
Yeah, it's a great question. Bus travel was fairly new, which is why buses were all of a sudden like all the rage in movies at this point. But like I said, they were not successful. So nobody thought anything of a movie set on a bus. Anyone who has titles to throw out, go ahead and throw them in the chat. But the idea of traveling like across any, you know, distance and having a comedy be part of it was not really something that was successfully done until this film.
That was kind of my thought. That was what I was thinking. And I mean, I was trying to pull back onto that, the idea of how this is a depression and why that, whether it was overt or not, or what kind of identifiers. And to me, the idea of travel and kind of social class and mobility, all these things are folks kind of being super successful and then dropping in the success. But I'm not a big Capra, like, I don't know his filmography, but I'm a huge It's a Wonderful Life fan. And I always see that so like, eternally optimistic, but he really can tap into the, like, that's a dark, dark movie to me, but at the same time. So it was something to me, I guess, that I don't know where I was going with all that, but I guess the how he frames it in a really large way, that there's all these social classes, but it's also like a love story and it's American and all these things. And I had written down some things, but that's basically my thought on it. Yeah, that road pictures might be the kind of just the vehicle upon as what is kind of looking at depressions and but also being optimistic and kind of having those two things hitting each other.
Yeah, and having the vehicle kind of move its way through the land, like, kind of takes you to the different slices of life that they encounter, which I think definitely does.
That's definitely American and like different. And it's not, I mean, the bus is one, but was there a train? I don't know if there's a train or not. I know there's a train passing with the hobo folk and the wave or the stop.
They're in cars, yeah.
Or they were in cars, but weren't the trains passing by? There was a train intersection. Then they make the point about the auto gyro and kind of thing, as far as like the flying guy. So there's definitely modes of transportation as a kind of motif or whatnot. But anyway.
I'm so glad somebody finally said the auto gyro. Yeah.
Yeah, it's definitely on my tongue.
What there. A weird wedding. Yeah.
Anyway, thanks. Thank you.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Joseph?
Can't hear you, Joe.
Okay, sorry about that. That was great comments just now, because you brought up a lot of stuff that none of us were talking about, and we started thinking about, you know, the fact that somebody wrote a chat that there weren't any a lot of highways at that point, so there wasn't a lot of cross country travel. But going back to how Capra treats, you know, the upper society of our world or of our country, this was the first film where he really made fun of these people. He even makes fun of Walter Connolly, and he's kind of a nice guy in this. But anybody that makes a lot of money, or anybody that's a politician, this started a career of Capra, you know, supporting and championing, I guess, what he called the common man. Mm-hmm. I agree with what you said earlier about how politics were different back then, and I've always thought Capra was a hardcore liberal. Always, it shows in his work, and the only time he doesn't really get into it is when it's stuff that, you know, he didn't create himself or Riskin didn't write, you know, Arsenic and Old Lace or You Can't Take It With You. But even his later films, even State of the Union, you know, is good politicians against bad politicians. Even stuff like A Hole in the Head with Sinatra, the rich guys in the movie, the Keenan Wynn character is a total loser. The Sinatra character that is, you know, he's considered kind of a, you know, a bum by his brother. He's the little guy trying to make it work. This was the creed of Capra. It got even more defined after the war. It just told it in a different way. But I think Capra was a lifelong liberal.
I would also point everyone toward the 1933 movie that I had mentioned that he made right before it happened one night. That was his first kind of big hit, called Lady for a Day. It's a beautiful movie about very much a Depression era movie. About a woman who sells apples on the street corner and finds out that her daughter, who's been living in Europe, has been thinking that she's this wealthy mother, this wealthy matron, and is engaged to this high level guy and trying to bring him to meet her mother, who's an apple saleswoman on the street. But she has to get everybody in the neighborhood together to dress her up as this, wealthy society woman and pretend that she is as worthy as her daughter thinks she is. And it's a really beautiful movie that kind of sets the tone for this also, this, like, you know, the underdog, the everyday guy making it. I saw a couple other ones, and I'm seeing some great road movies thrown into the chat. Absolutely. Yeah.
Polly?
Yeah, I just wanted to bring up before we close, also there's some really wonderful directorial touches and just shot making that's subtle, but I love the tracking shot in the motor camp while she's going to the bath is quite beautiful. And I think, you know, there was a reason for it, which we talked about, but it was subtle. But also the scene in the second Walls of Jericho motor place where it's the key moment and it's played off her back, like she's in her negligee.
Yeah.
And then you just see the blanket and then like he's just a shadow. And I thought that was really an extraordinary shot. So give him credit for that.
Absolutely. Yeah, no, thank you for bringing that up. So many Capra touches that make this movie so much what it is.
Utila?
Yeah, hi. So I loved everybody's comments, and it's a favorite film of mine too. I wrote about Capra's Lost Horizon was a whole chapter in my dissertation. So,
oh, wow.
So I, and you know, from at USC, so I kind of had to do a lot about him, and we did work on It Happened One Night too. But so I was thinking about the screwball piece, and I love the fact that she tests his moral character, you know, the flipping that part. And I thought that is still so unusual for the scripting to go that way, you know, where he's on test, you know, he's tested entirely. And then the fact that he has to cook her breakfast. So.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, it's such a great point. I'm so excited. I have to read your dissertation. Yeah. Thank you for sharing that. I know we're coming up on the hour here, but I also saw William had his hand up for a while. I didn't want to lose you here.
Oh yeah, my question, which has already been kind of addressed in the chat, was just about the movie's title, because I didn't know anything about the movie before I watched it, and I couldn't have told you at all what it was going to be about from the title. It's interesting you say the story was called The Night Bus, and you can see why they thought maybe that wasn't going to sell as many tickets, calling it What Happened One Night. But then I was kind of thinking, well, it's a lot of nights. Which right. night are we talking about? And of course, it's, as Alan, I think, rightly pointed out, it's the start of a story. Maybe it even was the first line of the story itself. I don't know. You can imagine it as the start of a story, presumably the story as told by the Clark Gable character. But yeah, I was just wondering what people thought of the title and if it was commercially vague because bus pictures weren't doing well. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, probably it becomes parodied. If you were with us for Sunset Boulevard, the It Happened opening of a title, this was the first time that was used, but there were so many It Happened. It Happened in Brooklyn. It Happened in, you know, It Happened at the World's Fair. It happened. So many movies started with the phrase It Happened, like, especially in the 1940s. And probably because this movie was such a hit, it really caught on. And in Sunset Boulevard, there's like this throwaway line where William Holden's character is a struggling screenwriter, and the studio head says, well, why don't we rename it? It Happened in, you know, and that'll make it a hit, because it was just that this was a title that really inspired, I guess, the imagination, or at least the beginning of the title. Yeah, It Happened in the Bullpen. Thank you, Alan. Sunset Boulevard. But yeah, I know that we are just past the 8:30 time cutoff, and I know we could talk about this movie easily for another hour, but I want to respect everyone's time. I'm so grateful you all were here, and I hope you'll join us again next month for Ninotchka 1939. That's going to be on April 12th, and more great things coming down the line in terms of movies that you'll be able to see on the big screen too, so I hope you'll see them in the theaters. Thank you all so much, and enjoy 31 Days of Oscar if you're able to catch it.
Thank you, everybody. And thank you so much, Hannah, for running this amazing classic Hollywood series for us month after month. We really appreciate it.